18th century. They became part of the war efforts in the North and the South, on and off the battlefields. Her book, Capital Dames, looks at what women in Washington, D.C. were doing in the mid-19th century, before, during, and after the Civil War. They transformed themselves from belles to social activists, journalists, nurses, suffragists. Her book includes profiles of women from many walks of life, including a fearless and outspoken Rose Greenhow, who was a Confederate spy, former slave Elizabeth Keckley, who was a seamstress and confidant to Mary Todd Lincoln, and Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis, who questioned the Confederacy. We'll talk about these dames. We'll also talk about Hillary Rodham Clinton, Claire Underwood, Michelle Obama, and women in politics. An official introduction, Cokie Roberts, political commentator for NPR and for ABC News. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Wonderful to be here, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Was there a Rosie the Riveter of the American Civil War?
Yes, absolutely. There were women who worked in the arsenals, and it was very dangerous work. They were stuffing cartridges and making ammunition. And in Washington, in fact, there was a horrible explosion at the arsenal, and a couple of dozen very young women were killed, and the newspaper accounts of the tragedy are horrendous. They're the day after the explosion. They're uncovering the charred bodies, which are unrecognizable. One was recognized by her shoes. But the reporter also commented on their hoop skirts and how they were trapped in their hoop skirts. So here are these women off to do this dangerous, stiflingly hot work, and they're dressed properly as mid-century proper ladies. It was a huge, huge funeral led by President Lincoln and Secretary of War Stanton, where thousands of people turned out to honor these women who had worked so hard for the war effort.
It was so interesting to read about the number of women who worked in government.
Right.
Essentially, the men had either gone off to war or gone off to some, front of the war, and they filled the...
It was very interesting. They started showing up in Washington to make a living. You know, the men had gone off, but they showed up just as Congress passed a law permitting the printing of paper money to pay for the war. And money still comes off of the press in these great huge sheets, right? And, of course, now it's cut into bills by machines. Then it was cut by hand with scissors. And the treasurer of the United States, General Skinner, said women are just better with scissors than men are. And, of course, we can pay them a lot less, which is something NPR has always felt as well. But the fact is that they came,
I digress.
They came into government in large numbers. And at the end of the, later in his life, General Skinner said that that was one of the smartest things he had done, was to bring women into government. And by the end of the war, one of the journalists, of whom there were also quite a few, said that there were women of education in every department of government. And, of course, they didn't go home.
That was my next question, whether, sort of like World War II, whether they went home or whether
There's a myth that everybody went home in World War II. And some people, of course, did go home, and there were women displaced by men coming back. But keep in mind, 60,000 women took advantage of the GI Bill after World War II. You don't think about that. And that's led us to where we are today, with the majority of college graduates being female, the vast majority of graduate school graduates being female. That all started with the war.
You wrote, and I scribbled this down because I did not know this, that there were no female nurses at the time of the
right.
Civil War.
It was just not women's work. And but women, of course, nursed at home all the time, and plantation mistresses nursed everybody on the plantation. But it was not official. And so Dorothea Dix, who is really someone, you know, you think you know about her, but most people, I would argue, probably do not. She was, of course, this advocate for the mentally ill, but she was so influential that before the war, the Senate gave her an office in the Capitol from which to do her lobbying. And she was lobbying for the federal government to put aside 12 million acres for the poor and the mentally ill. She got the bill through both houses of Congress, but the president vetoed it, President Pierce. But she then showed up in Washington as the war began and became the – volunteered as the superintendent of female nurses. So women started nursing. There were only like three women doctors in the country at the time. And one of them, Mary Walker, did also show up in Washington to volunteer. And, well, she wanted to be paid, but she ended up volunteering because nobody would pay her. She was a surgeon. She dressed like a man, which meant she got arrested from time to time. She is still, Marty, the only female to have won the Medal of Honor.
Oh, fascinating.
Yes.
Fascinating. Well, one of the there are many women in here that I found fascinating, including Verena Davis, the wife of Jefferson Davis. He was the president of the Confederacy. I mean, not a shy retiring type at all.
No. Although these women did describe themselves as belles, as you said earlier. And she was one of the belles in Washington before the war, vying for first place. But she was – here's the great thing. Women's letters are so much better than men's letters. You know, the men knew they were doing something that would probably get recorded and preserved and published, so they were very careful and pompous in their letters. The women just wrote letters, and so they're funny and frank and feisty and
gossipy,
wonderfully gossipy, and they've got tons of political news in them. But they also have fashion and who's all too often losing babies and the economic situation's all there. But she at one point wrote to her mother because one of the other belles, Adele Cutts, who was this beautiful, kind, smart girl. They were so young, you know, whom everybody loved. And she was Dolly Madison's great niece. So she had a position even though no man in her life did. But she was about to marry Stephen Douglas. And Verena Davis was furious that this was happening and wrote to her mother, "The dirty speculator and party trickster, broken in health by drink, with his first wife's money, buys an elegant, well-bred woman because she is poor and her father is proud." And then Verena says it's a good thing a new water system is coming to town so that sparing his wife's olfactories, Douglas may wash a little oftener. If he don't, his acquaintance will build larger rooms with more perfect ventilation. So we only know from woman that Stephen Douglas smelled bad.
He didn't take enough baths.
Right.
But she's very interesting because it does feel like she – I don't know if ambivalence is too strong a word, but she wasn't entirely behind the
Confederacy. I think ambivalence is an appropriate word. She wasn't behind it, and she didn't think it could succeed. She was clear-eyed about what the manufacturing situation was, what the transportation situation was. She realized that this could not survive as a country on its own. But she did her duty as the First Lady of the Confederacy, and then after the war, she lobbied Andrew Johnson to get Jefferson Davis out of jail. He had been arrested in theory as part of the Lincoln assassination plot, which was a crock, but he was in jail. And then they had a very difficult life. They have a tempestuous marriage. He's never able to really get a job and hold a job. They're separated at periods. And finally, he dies. And she moves to New York, much to the distress of the South, the First Lady of the Confederacy going to this Yankee place, right? But she had always sort of chafed against the Southern belle role, and she had never been sufficiently pale to be a true Southern belle. She was a little olive-complected. And so she wrote to her daughter when she was moving to New York and said, "I am free, brown, and 64. I can do whatever I want to do."
I like that as a bumper sticker.
I know, exactly.
It would work perfectly.
And then when she moved to New York, she made her living writing for the New York World. But she befriended Julia Grant. And that, Marty, I think is so important because she understood that what she was doing was an act of reconciliation. It was page one news and all over the country when the two of them met. And then she went to the dedication of the Grant Memorial, all of this by way of trying to bring the country back together.
Were there questions about her olive skin? I mean, yes. Was that an issue at that time?
Yes, yes. I mean, and I don't know whether it was implied that there was anything, mixed blood there. It's hard to imagine that because we know her origins. Right. The big problem wasn't really the color. It was that her grandfather was governor of New Jersey.
Perish the thought. Right. But it's interesting to compare her to Mary Todd Lincoln.
There are a lot of similarities.
I was wondering about that.
She's a much more even-keeled person than Mary Todd Lincoln, who today we would probably call bipolar. But Mary Lincoln was from Kentucky, and the Northerners suspected her because she had many relatives in the Confederate Army. And then she lost a baby before they came to Washington, a two-year-old, and then her child Willie died in the White House. Verena Davis came from, her grandfather from New Jersey. She was educated in Philadelphia, so there was a, suspicion of her of not being Southern enough. And she had a baby die in Washington, a two-year-old, and then her 10-year-old was killed for a fall when he was in Richmond when she was First Lady. So they had many things in common. The difference was Verena Davis could pull herself together and do her duty. Mary Lincoln could not.
But it also speaks to just how difficult life was. Even if you were well-connected at the time, that you would lose
getting
children.
Through the day in the 19th century was really hard.
Because
everything was hard. There were no modern conveniences. There was, just surviving the day was not easy.
They go from bells to dames. Did you do that to them?
I did do that to them, but I don't see anything wrong with a dame. There's nothing like a dame. And we have colonial dames. In fact, one of the women in this book was Sarah Pryor, was one of the founders of the colonial dames and the Daughters of the American Revolution. Again, she was a Confederate working with people after the war who had stayed true to the Union to go back in time to start these institutions that reminded people of when the country was all one country.
And we're almost up on a break here, but it's a good reminder about Washington, D.C. at this time, how maybe undivided it was or how mixed up it was.
At the beginning, before the war, it was definitely Southern. But the people were on all sides, and they remained good friends. The women did.
That's Cokie Roberts, a voice very familiar to listeners of WHYY, and she is a political commentator for NPR. She's written a number of books about women in American history, and her new book is called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, and a little bit later on in the hour, we'll be talking about some of the current dames in Washington, D.C., and certainly talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton and her run for the White House. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Cokie Roberts. And if you're just joining us, she's got a new book. It's called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. I mentioned Elizabeth Keckley in your book, and this she has been written about, but she's still an absolutely fascinating
character.
She
is, and a lot of people, even though she has been written about, a lot of people don't know about her. She was a slave. She bought her freedom. She got to Washington. She was a very, very talented dressmaker, a couturier. And she made dresses for all the prominent women, Elizabeth Blair Lee, Verena Davis, all of them. And then when Mary Lincoln came to town, of course, she wanted the best. And so she hired Mrs. Keckley. And Mary Lincoln was not really liked by the women of Washington. She was a difficult person, and they didn't like the president. So it was, you know, an issue. She therefore befriended the people who worked for her, and Elizabeth Keckley became her closest confidant. Mrs. Keckley took care of Mrs. Lincoln when Willie died. She took care of her after the president was shot, when Mary Lincoln stayed in the White House for a couple of months and was really out of her mind. And then Mrs. Keckley went with her to Illinois. And she had heard all of the conversations between the president and First Lady. They were not hidden. And Mary Lincoln also expressed her views without any kind of governor about the cabinet members and all of that. And Elizabeth Keckley then wrote a tell-all book, and just like people in the White House do now. And, of course, it totally destroyed the relationship, but it does give us quite an insight into the Lincoln White House.
Well, indeed, and just as you say, and maybe about the social scene in Washington. Right. I don't know how different it is today. You know, when the outsiders come to town, that would be the president, and and the family comes to town, whether there's still those sort of social mores.
It depends on the president, you know. And, I mean, Buchanan, a terrible president, but the but people in Washington liked Harriet Lane, his niece, although they thought she was a little bit stuck up.
You have here, this is for John C. Fremont. He was running for president, and there's I guess it's a ticket on this top. It says for president, big letters, smaller letters, John C. Fremont, husband of, big letters, Jesse Benton.
Jesse Benton Fremont was absolutely out there on the public stage, not behind the scenes at all. And John Fremont was the first Republican nominee for president. The brand new Republican Party nominated him in 1856. And all the posters were Fremont and our Jesse. Nobody knew who was running for vice president. And the newspapers all talked about how she could explain the platform better than anybody else. People, you know, named their children after her, dressed like her, all of that. And that was a Democratic newspaper opposing him, saying, you know, he should just be fade into the background and just say, okay, it's just Jesse who's really running on this ticket. It was quite something.
You know, it's interesting to think about the Civil War. I think something like 2% of the American population died during that war.
More than 600,000 Americans lost their lives in the Civil War.
Yeah.
It is a horrible, horrible story. And obviously the enormous good of the end of slavery came out of it. But what a failure of statesmanship that you had to go to war to achieve that end.
Another woman that you do write about, and again, she could have a whole movie, I think, about her, Rose Greenhow, the Confederate spy.
Yes, she was a Washington personage. Again, she was, by marriage, Dolly Madison's kind of niece. And she was a hostess, entertained people of both parties. She also did some entertaining late at night with the curtains drawn, and she was able to get a great deal of information. And she is credited with getting the news to the Confederates about what the Yankees were going to do at the Battle of Manassas, Bull Run, the first big battle of the war. And everybody thought that the North would win. That would be it. They all went out, you know, with picnics thinking it was a lark. And then the South won that battle. And she was able to get the information to the Southern generals to win.
And she went to jail, I
she
guess,
ended up
with
being
her
jail.
Child.
With her child, little Rose. She ended up going to jail and was there for several months, and then finally sent to the South, to Richmond, where Jefferson Davis came to greet her in her hotel and told her, you know, that she had done fabulous service to the Confederacy. And then he sent her to England to propagandize for the South, because they were constantly trying to get France and England to recognize the Confederacy. And she told her story and got people outraged against the Yankees and all of that. And then she was smuggling gold back into the Confederacy, and her ship ran aground, and she drowned because her dress was so filled with gold that it brought her down to the bottom.
There's a theme here of women's clothing doing them in.
Doing them in, right. Yes, we're wise not to either sew gold into our hems or to wear hoops.
Or to wear hoop skirts as well. So how much digging do you have to go to find these letters, for instance?
A lot. Some are published. Some of Verena Davis's letters to Jefferson Davis and her parents are published. Elizabeth Blair Lee, whose father, Francis Preston Blair, was a Lincoln confidant. Her brother Montgomery was in the cabinet. Her brother Frank was in the Congress. Her husband, Phillips Lee, a cousin of Robert E., but was an officer in the Union Navy. Mm. And because he was in the Navy, she wrote to him every day. So there are thousands of letters. And the wartime letters are published. The others are not. That was about it for published letters. And so the rest, it really was going digging and finding letters that had never been published. But that's always a real treat because it's you're on a hunt.
Yes.
And you find these wonderful things. I mean, Abigail Brooks Adams, I had found her mother-in-law in my last book, Ladies of Liberty, my last history book, Ladies of Liberty. Her mother-in-law, Louisa Catherine Adams, John Quincy Adams' wife, had some wonderful, wonderful letters that at the time had never been published. Now they have been, but that were just great. And then now I found her letters, and she is the wife of Charles Francis Adams, John Quincy Adams' son. He was in Congress for a term, but it was the infamous term when the South seceded. And then he went to become the Union's ambassador to the Court of St. James. But in that term, when he was in Congress, she was writing these fabulous letters home to Henry Adams, her son, and saying things like, Buchanan is a heavy old toad, and the Senate behaved like children, and silly ones at that, which I could totally get behind. But my personal favorite was, I would advise any young woman who wishes to have an easy, quiet life not to marry an Adams.
Well said. Let me reintroduce you. That's Cokie Roberts, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, political commentator for NPR and for ABC News. She has written a number of books about women in this country. We Are Our Mother's Daughters, Founding Mothers, Ladies of Liberty, and again, her new one called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. So are we going to keep going from here?
I don't know. You know, this is like saying you've just had triplets. What's your next child?
Right.
The Civil War, I was never going to write about the Civil War. All my ancestors were on the losing side.
Well, I was curious about that.
but the publisher really wanted a Civil War book, and we have just gone through the sesquicentennial. So I don't know. I don't know what the name. But I'll keep writing history, yes, because it's really, really interesting.
More interesting than talking about politics today?
Well, you know, you don't get the same feedback because they're dead.
Well, that helps.
It's really nice.
But, you know, I mean, it is in – we are, you know, just celebrating 150 years of the Civil War. But it still feels as if it's – there's some rawness to that war.
It's unbelievable. You know, people are still fighting it. I did a presentation at the National Archives the other day, and some woman got up and just started railing against Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, you just say, give it up. it's over. But people have trouble giving it up.
But did you have family that fought then for the Confederacy?
Yes. I mean, my mother is just died a year and a half ago, and she's buried in the town where she grew up in New Roads, Louisiana, in Pointe-Coupee Parish. And her grandfather's mausoleum, you know, in Louisiana, we bury people above ground. We always say so we can get them to the polls easier. But his marker is there, and it says CSA, Confederate States of America.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, do you think – When you lose a war, it just is more painful, and there was a lot of
keeping alive the lost cause and all of that. But honestly, you look at what the South was before the war and what it became after the war, and you just think those politicians have a lot of answering to do.
Mm, indeed. Let me open up the lines to our phones, and it's 1-888-477-9499. And again, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation with Cokie Roberts talking about her new book, Capital Dames. Well, let me just make a gigantic leap from the Civil War to today. There are 20 women who are senators in the U.S. Senate. And it's funny, I scribbled notes here, still not close to, and I wrote parody, P-A-R-O-D-Y. I meant to write P-A-R.
It might be close to parody.
I meant to write parody, P-A-R-I-T-Y. But I'm obviously progress,
right?
But nonetheless.
Huge progress, actually, because, you know, for most of my life, there were never more than two women in the Senate. 20 is, you know, even I can do this math. It's 20% of the Senate. And it's a critical mass. And that does make a big difference. And they are, those women form the only real bastion of bipartisanship in the Congress. Mm-hmm. And they do it quite consciously. They have regular dinners. I'm always teasing them that they just want to be someplace, you know, testosterone free. And they admit that's true, but that they also get a great deal done.
Right.
And you know, when things happen like the shutdown of government, it was the women senators who basically said, oh, for God's sake, you know, this is ridiculous. Let's do our job here.
I mean, you think they're the grown-ups and the
yes,
men and
I
the
do.
Boys?
Pretty much so, yeah. We do have data from the Center on American Women in Politics at Rutgers that over the decades from state legislatures that women are more pragmatic and less ideological. Obviously, this is a broad statement in legislative bodies than men tend to be. And they cross party lines more often, particularly on issues that affect women, children, and families.
Mm-hmm. Let me get Marjorie to join us from West Philadelphia. I should say Marjorie Margolis, who Cokie Roberts
Hi,
might
Cokie.
Know who you are. Go ahead, Marjorie.
Hi, Marge. How are you?
How are you? I want everybody to know how phenomenal you are. You're so special.
How's the baby, Marge?
Oh, it's definitely not going to be a neglected child.
Well, we need to fill our listeners in, Marge. You need to expand who you are and why this baby is a topic of conversation.
Well, I actually had a life before your question.
Before your son married Chelsea Clinton.
Yeah,
exactly.
I started out a little bit in broadcasting and then did a drive-by in Congress.
Right.
Until
Bill Clinton needed your vote and you gave it to him and lost. That was predictable. but noble.
Go ahead, Mark.
A little certifiable. And but and then I started an organization, actually, after the Fourth World Conference, trying to help women, leadership women, you know, become leaders around the world. And it's been amazing. And I have to get together with you on that, Cokie, but I know that that's not the topic now. The thing that interested me so much was, and I was in the car listening to you, so I took a break. I don't know if you covered it. But the 1848 Seneca Falls meeting, only one person lived to vote. Only one person lived
long enough to be able to vote. Well, think about it. I mean, the vote didn't happen until 1920, so it's a lot of years in between. And I don't cover that convention because the book is set in Washington. But the very end of the book is the Grant inauguration. And a couple of weeks before that, celebrating the 20th year since Seneca Falls, the women met in Washington, the Women's Suffrage Party, or whatever they called themselves. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, after 600,000 men were killed in the war, that it was pretty obvious that men could not do this alone, that women's voices were needed in government.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, Marjorie, so. I anything else you want to say before we say goodbye to you?
No, I really do want to. This is such a fascinating conversation.
Thanks.
And good for you, Cokie.
Well, I hope to see you soon.
Thanks a lot, Marjorie.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times, Marjorie Margolis. You can call as well. You don't have to be the grandmother of
Charlotte.
Charlotte Mezvinsky, I think it is.
Charlotte Clinton Mezvinsky.
You can call us at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Well, it's actually a very nice segue to talking about Hillary Rodham Clinton, who is running for president again, as we know. But in the last couple of weeks, you know, the email controversy, questions about the Clinton Foundation and foreign donors. And I was just wondering from your perspective, whether is it something about the Clintons or is it something about how people respond to the Clintons?
All of the above. I keep saying about Hillary Clinton that she's basically running against herself. And she doesn't have any opposition to speak of in the Democratic Party. And so the whole question is, how does the campaign play out? Does she have issues that come up that people are concerned about? Does she make mistakes? It's almost impossible to have a mistake-free campaign.
Sure.
But
do her mistakes get magnified?
Absolutely. And it does seem to be the case that the guy who's written this book about the money is a Republican operative and has, according to his own admission, absolutely no evidence that there was any quid for the quo, right? But so they do attract – the Clintons do attract this kind of negative press, but they also get themselves in position where it's not hard.
So giving their opponents –
ammunition
to use against them.
Right.
I mean, we're almost up in a break here. We did a show a couple of weeks ago when Hillary made it official after will she, won't she for so many months, it seemed. And a woman called in. She said, I hate her.
Oh, well, that's
– I hate her. I don't – and she's ambitious. I mean, she
– She said ambitious?
She did.
Oh, gosh. See, that's so sad. I mean, you say ambitious about a man, and there's nothing wrong with that. And it's still a problem to be an ambitious woman.
I mean, you think, what is it, 2015, still a problem?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, if that was your caller's response, it's probably indicative of others as well.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Cokie Roberts is our guest in this hour of Radio Times, political commentator for NPR and for ABC News, also the author of a new book called Capital Dames. So the Civil War and the Women of Washington. This is back in the 19th century. I do want to talk about what's going on today. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Cokie Roberts about her new book, Capital Dames. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me go back to Hillary Rodham Clinton or Hillary Clinton. I mean, part of her campaign seems to either be to kind of reintroduce herself to the American people or to humanize her. And I just was wondering what you think about all of that.
Which is why the baby will be, you know, a part of it. But she – you know, the truth is if Hillary Clinton were sitting here right now, you'd have a delightful conversation with her and she'd be funny. She has a good sense of humor. She's just become this sort of creature in the public eye who is not regular. And part of that is that she has been in the public eye for so long, and part of it is that she has come under so much attack that it makes you skittish and hesitant to just answer questions and get out there. So I think she's trying to, you know, tell people that she is a real person. And when she talks about her mother's story, for instance, it's really quite moving. And of course, she herself has worked hard all of her life, all of that. But she has lived in the cocoon of public service, which is in one way a cocoon and another way the most public thing you can possibly do. So
sure.
it's a funny combination of things. You're driven around in black SUVs and you have a Secret Service. And when you're governor, you have, you know, state troopers. But the whole world watches you. But I still think that she has a very, very strong chance of being elected president if she doesn't do damage to herself. And that has a lot to do with demographics. You know, with,
demographics.
Right.
Just sort of
where the add up the numbers, right. You know.
Well, and something that her campaign didn't do a very good job, I guess, when they took on
Barack Obama
the first go-round.
Well, that was sui generis. You know, this was this young, attractive African-American at a time when the country was eager for change. Now voters are saying they'd prefer experience to change. You know, people react to the last war all of the time. And the Republicans, you know, are working hard to alienate Hispanics and young people, and they've already lost African Americans, and so she combines those and what she does get, at least at the moment, that most Democratic candidates do not get, is white women, and if she can hold on to white women with the others without alienating the others, it's hard to defeat her.
What do you make of Elizabeth Warren? I mean, she's got people that want her to run. I mean, how many times has she been asked that question? She always says no.
Well, she always, for a long time, she only said it in the present tense. Everyone was parsing it.
Yes.
Yeah. But I think that she's a force in the party, and that there's a lot of desire on the part of many people in the Democratic Party to say, don't be so cozy with Wall Street and the fat cats and all of that. The big danger is that voice is strong and it's sincere, but it's tiny. And when you look at the number of people who identify themselves as liberals, it's never more than about 20-22%. So you don't want to put yourself in a position where you are only speaking to the true believers, which is the problem the Republicans have.
Well, and this is not fair at all, but I was sort of contrasting in my own mind, Hillary Clinton has to reintroduce herself all the time and humanize herself, and Elizabeth Warren
just can hang out.
Well, and we don't know anything about her family.
Right.
She doesn't have to, to talk that way. She can talk policy as opposed to, you know, more personal stuff.
Well, if she got into a race, the personal stuff would certainly all be out there.
Right.
I mean, it is for anybody. And I actually think that's fine. Look, the way we elect a president is not on policy. We elect a president on a gut check where we say, do I trust this person to do what I would think the right thing to do over the next 4 years, because I don't have a clue what's going to happen. I don't know that the Twin Towers are going to be attacked. I don't know that the Berlin Wall is going to fall. I don't know these things. So I want to go for the person that I think has the best judgment, or at least better judgment than the other person.
Ah, interesting. Let me get David from, looks like, Central New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Hi, Marty and Cokie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask succinctly, what do you think the real reason, Cokie, is that Elizabeth Warren isn't running for president now?
Because she'd lose. I think that's the main reason.
Lose to Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you, David?
Anybody who's got her finger on the pulse of what the major problems are with income inequality than Elizabeth Warren, and I think her support is enormous.
Well, her support is very deep, but it's not very wide. And that's what you have to have when you're running for president.
So, I mean, certain ways, figuring out when the time is
right. That's right. That's right. And that's always a very difficult thing, because sometimes the time is never right and you have to go now, which is what you're seeing with people like Marco Rubio. You know, he could have said, well, I'll wait and Jeb Bush is running this time and I'm only 43 and I'll wait my turn. But, you know, the sun is shining on him right now, and if he waits, he could be in the shadows. And so, you know, different politicians make different calculations about these things.
David, thanks for the call. Let me see what Susan from Westchester has to say. Hi, Susan. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm just curious about whether the bill passed at the end of Bill Clinton's reign to allow the people from Congress and the Senate money to go home every weekend had anything to do with some of the log jam we're seeing now. In times past, the families moved to Washington. There were barbecues kids' games and opportunities to realize that one person is really fairly decent, even though some of their political views were just aren't.
Sure, Susan. It's a good question.
It is a good question, but it happened a long time before Bill Clinton's reign. It happened really with the Democratic class of 1974, the so-called Watergate babies. And they came in large numbers from districts, in many cases, that were not Democratic districts. They were elected in reaction to the Watergate scandal. And so in order to hold on to those districts, what they did was establish offices in the districts, all over the districts, go home for town meetings, and, yes, get paid to go – get the airfare home paid for. And that's really when it started to fall apart, was with that Democratic class of 1974. But you're quite right. I grew up in a time when it was families were there. My father was the Democratic leader of Congress when Gerry Ford was the Republican leader of Congress, and the families were very, very close friends. And you're right. We all did go to school together. The moms were, and it was the moms were in the PTA together, and we did have picnics. And you know, you can't demonize somebody that you're sitting next to in church. It's much harder.
Picking up on that, the president has been criticized for not schmoozing more or being more of sort of social with, and he leaves town, but he's often, I guess, in the White House on the weekends. I don't even know. But is that a problem? Has that been a problem for him?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is a problem for him. And he joked about it at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. You know, I'm aloof and arrogant. Mm-hmm. You know, how dumb are they? but I do think that it makes a difference to reach out to people, and a White House invitation makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
And we've had, you know, other presidents that haven't done that, and it does affect their ability to get things done in Congress.
What do you think of Michelle Obama?
I think she's terrific. I have twice had the great joy of being asked to moderate a discussion between her and Laura Bush for the African First Ladies Summit. And the two of them are so terrific together, and they are so genuinely respectful of each other and actually loving to each other that it just makes you wish that the men could behave in the same fashion.
Certain theme here
discussion
here. So do we need more women in government?
Yes, it helps to have more women in government. Absolutely. It is – women do tend to not only be, as I said earlier, more pragmatic, but they also bring the concerns of women, children, and families to the fore. And it's not that the men don't care. It's just that they don't put a high priority on them.
What do you think of Claire Underwood on House of Cards?
I have really reached the point where I can't watch it. And I know I sound like a really scolding school marm here, but Steve and I watched, a season or so. And finally, we just got to the point where we couldn't take it. And I think actually it does harm. I really do. I think that if people think that their elected representatives are murderers, that's not a good thing. Just saying.
And for her, I mean, she's very cold. Calculating. Kind of a Lady Macbeth.
She's terrifying, but looks great. But I find her a very off-putting human being.
Indeed. Let me see what Samuel from South Jersey has to say. Hi, Samuel. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. How's it going?
Good, how are you?
The comment I wanted to make was essentially that you're missing the point completely on Hillary Clinton. Now, Hillary Clinton is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and yet, in an interview, she sat down and quoted as saying, "I am not that wealthy."
Mm-hmm.
She thinks that as a person who is worth hundreds of millions of dollars, that she is not that wealthy, when the average American only has $10,000 or less in the bank.
Well, Sammy, let me take your comment, and she was roundly criticized.
Right.
For that.
She didn't say, "I'm not that wealthy." What she said was that when they left the White House, they were broke. And you know, that,
is there some truth to that?
There's some truth to that, but they knew that they had the ability to write book contracts of millions of dollars and to make speeches where they would make hundreds of thousands of dollars. So, you know, they might have been temporarily kind of broke, but that wasn't their reality as in terms of their wealth. And I think the gentleman is right. That's very off-putting to people to say something like that.
To say something like that. But is it off-putting to have wealthy, rich candidates running for office?
Well, we've had them many a time, and voters, you know, often say they don't like the idea, but they vote for them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No. Indeed. What do you make of Bill's while we're on the Clinton family here?
Well, Bill Clinton is, I think, you know, left the presidency trying to do good work through the foundation. And it's very – being an ex-president is tough. You need to do something significant, but you can't be in the way. He and President H.W. Bush worked together on several things, and it reached the point where, you know, Barbara Bush, who had initially been so hostile to the Clintons, said that, you know, he was her fifth son.
Right.
And so I think that's the great thing that happens after the presidency, is that they do tend to start working together. And I remember interviewing President Bush not long after he was president. I was doing it for WHYY, in fact, on a series on the Constitution. And he said, I don't think Clinton and I will ever be like Ford and Carter. And of course, President Carter had defeated President Ford, and yet the two of them worked very closely mm-hmm. together. And in fact, President Bush and President Clinton did end up being able to work together on a variety of things. And so I think that they do all see themselves in a statesman role after the presidency and try to find ways to make a difference.
Do you worry about our politics, our political system in
this
country?
I worry that it is polarized and poisoned. And when you read the period around the Civil War, you realize that that can be highly, highly dangerous. Thankfully, we do not have a major moral issue like slavery on the table, because I think we are not in a position right now to get to a point where we could work it out politically in a way that makes sense.
The Supreme Court is hearing this right. really important case involving state bans of same-sex marriage.
Tomorrow. And, you know, it's up in the air how they'll decide, because on the one hand, they have been moving toward outlawing bans on gay marriage. On the other hand, there's a states' rights issue. But I think that they have to be very careful here, because the public has moved faster on this issue than we've ever seen in human history. And now you had last week a poll, 61% favoring gay marriage, including, by the way, 60% of evangelicals under the age of 30. So it's not just liberals who are moving this way. It's across the board.
And why do you think that is?
I think because people have learned about people in their own families who they love. And the ABC poll had 75% of the people saying that they knew someone who was gay and lesbian, whereas in the 80s it was less than a quarter. And what that means is that very brave gay and lesbian people have come out and told their families and their friends about their lives. And once mm-hmm. that happens, you can't demonize it anymore. These are people you love.
Well, it's interesting because during this hour we've been talking about the political but the personal.
Right.
I mean, sort of how powerful when the political becomes the personal, how powerful that is.
That is, and that's one of the things women bring to politics, and women journalists do as well. And sometimes we get criticized for it mm-hmm. because we do write about the personal. But I think that if we're talking about character, you have to know the whole character.
Well, on that note, Cokie Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
So nice to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us as well. And again, political commentator for NPR and a political commentator for ABC News. She didn't want me to say this, but I'm going to add she won the Edward R. Murrow Award, 3 Emmys. And in 2008, the Library of Congress honored her with the rare title of living legend. And she has a new book. It's called Capital Dames, The Civil War and the Women of Washington, 1848 to 1868. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Send us an email. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Sirius Radio, sign up for our newsletter, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. Cokie Roberts has a busy day here at WHYY, and tonight at 7:30 she'll be at the Free Library of Philadelphia. And coming up next, our guest is Pennsylvania Senator Anthony Hardy Williams, one of the six Democrats running for mayor of Philadelphia. He'll be our guest coming up in the second hour Radio Time. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase and other centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Part of Temple Health, Fox Chase Cancer Center now offers next business day appointments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org.
This is WHYY-FM Philadelphia, WNJN-FM 89.7 Atlantic City, WNJZ 90.3 Cape May Courthouse, WNJB-FM 89.3 Bridgeton, WNJM 89.9 Manahawkin, and WNJS-FM 88.1 Berlin.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Pennsylvania primary is less than a month away on May 19th, and the race for mayor of the nation's fifth largest city, Philadelphia, is in full swing. We are presenting one-on-one interviews with the Democratic candidates for Radio Times, part of WHYY's extensive election coverage. You can check it out at the Newsworks blog 99. Today, our guest is Senator Anthony Hardy Williams to talk about his candidacy and the issues facing Philadelphia. I spoke last week with Lynn Abraham and Doug Oliver. And later this week, I'll sit down with Nelson Diaz, Milton Street, and Jim Kinney. Stay with WHYY in Philadelphia for more after the news from NPR.